Now, Christianity, the belief in the Lord Jesus Christ and following him, and those who gather in his church, Christianity is countercultural. What do I mean by the word countercultural? Well, Jesus teaches that human beings, all human beings, the human race, is a rebellious race, that human beings are rebels against God. You can call us sinners or whatever other terms you use, rebels against the God who made us. And one of the implications of that is that whatever society we build, in whatever style, with whatever background, political doctrine that drives it, whatever economic system that shapes it, whatever philosophical system that informs it, whatever society we build with its laws and with its practices and with its cultures and with its beliefs, it will always fall far short of what God wants. It may have good elements in it, whichever society you're thinking of. There may be things which are admirable, but sin, especially human pride, a boasting of our own abilities, and human idolatry, a willingness constantly to reshape God into the form that suits us, those two sins and other sins will always spoil every part of any society. And so what does the Lord Jesus do? He calls people to repent, to turn from that, to see their sin. He calls them to believe in him and find forgiveness. And then he puts them into a new kingdom. A new society, his people, his kingdom, that he rules. And that kingdom does have a life that honours God. It has a different way of life. He teaches us to turn away from the sinful paths and to walk in his ways which please and honour God. Now, all of that means this, that if you are truly a Christian, then whatever society you live in, so we all live in the UK at the moment, though some of you have lived in other societies, in other parts of the world at different times of your lives, that whatever society we live in, we don't assume its views are right. We learn first from Christ as our King about what is right. And then we assess other things in the light of that. But that can bring trouble. In fact, it inevitably does bring trouble. Often in history, Christians as a result are viewed as social misfits. And then that often descends into being social dangers. A threat to the stability of society because they keep insisting on assessing things by what Christ has taught them. Now, they don't just assume that what society says is good is good. And so often we clash with our surrounding culture. Countercultural is just a word that describes that type of clash. Christianity is countercultural. It clashes with the prevailing society around it. Now, that word isn't only used of Christians, it's used of other belief systems too. But you get the idea. At the moment in China, it's very visible. The authorities in China at the moment, at least in some provinces, because China's a vast country, are seeking to close in on Christians because they're not being true to the culture. They've recently asked possibly the largest church in China to install cameras in their room for security purposes, so that they can watch who comes and goes to the services. The church said no, so they shut them down. Because they're not being true to the culture. To other churches, they say to them, burn your crosses, put up the Chinese flag, respect what China stands for. They understand very clearly Christianity is countercultural. It clashes with the surrounding culture. Now, this is seen, Christians sort of pushing against what's around them in all kinds of ways, but it tends to come to a sharp focus over particular issues. And it will be the issues which influence a society strongly. So in China, it is the centrality and the importance of socialism and the Communist Party. You get clashes there. In the UK, we can think of other ways in which Christians are countercultural. So Christians in the UK want to talk of God publicly. But for many in our culture, God and religion are private. You keep them to yourself. You don't talk about them. They're not to come into the workplace. They're not to come into politics. They're not to be spoken of ideally, even out on the streets. You just shut up. Keep it to yourself. It's a clash. Christians aim for sexual purity. We believe that there is a normal pattern to sexual behaviour that God has designed. But our society simply says, no, it isn't. Anything goes. You fancy doing that with some part of your body, you go ahead and do it. We clash with the culture that's around us. And that's what you get. You get these clash points. It will vary from different places, but you get these clash points. And in fact, the Lord often uses them. The Lord often uses them to challenge societies in our world. He purposely brings the gospel in a way that does expose particular sins that shape and form a society. Things, areas of life that a society says, well, we think this is fine and acceptable and normal. And the gospel comes in and says, oh, no, it's not at all. And that becomes the clash point. Now, if you've been here for Acts, you'll know that we've tried to see that by looking through the book of Acts. From Acts chapter 16 through to chapter 18, we've gone through five cities, or we've just arrived at city number five. They're in Macedonia and Achaia, the area we would maybe now call Greece. And we've travelled down with Paul through them. And in each one, there's been a different clash point. He started up in Philippi. Philippi was an incredibly proud city, had a great history. Some fine emperors came from there. The gospel there came with a focus on humility, because their pride was wrong. Then he went to Thessalonica, a successful city, very self-serving. We read from bits of his letters later about his time there, where he had a focus, that's Paul, in preaching and in living on serving others, because people were so self-serving in that city. That was the clash point. We saw him in Athens. And in Athens, what Paul noticed were the idols. Because in Athens, people were like gods. They were thought of as so brilliant with their great philosophical past. And gods were like people. Everywhere you looked was a statue of a god, but it looked like some sort of superhuman. So the gospel came with a focus on Jesus as the true living image of God. Because that was the clash point, to deny their idolatry. In each place, the Christian gospel had to clash with some cultural norm, some cultural attitude, and say, this is wrong. That became the clash point. Now that's going to happen again in chapter 18. We've arrived at an important Greek city, Corinth. And here, Paul once again, or the Lord rather, through Paul, is going to clash with that society in a different way again. Because this society has something unique to it, some trait, some attitude that needs handling. So let's take a look at it. What I'll do is this, I'll give you a brief sketch of the city. We'll look at verses 1 to 8 today and go on to the other verses in a couple of weeks. And as we go, we'll ponder some lessons from it. Okay, geography lesson first. Corinth is situated near an isthmus. I can never say that word. Isthmus. How do you say that? Right, firstly, somebody say the word isthmus for me that I can't say properly.
Isthmus.
Thank you. Excellent. Prize to Brian at the back for his birthday and for saying it correctly. Now somebody tell me what it is.
Isthmus.
It's not Christmas. Why didn't you just drop the CH off the front?
A peninsula surrounded by water.
A peninsula surrounded by water. You have a narrow strip of land, you have a sea on one side, sea on the other, and the land is in between the two. And therefore the land connects those two seas for you. That's where Corinth was. It was in that type of area. If you have one of the slightly faded service leaflets from today, because my printer is dying, you actually have a map that shows you Corinth, and you will see when you've written the word Corinth in, under whichever the correct number is for the answer, you will see it's on an isthmus. I can't get the TH in front of the M. I can't do it. It's on one of those things. Corinth had two harbours as a result, and it had a road in between them. So a harbour for the Eastern Sea and a harbour for the Western Sea. The road in between was an important link. You could bring your goods into one harbour, you could load them onto something, push them to the other harbour, and they could set off in the other direction. So it became a very important link between the east and western sides of the Roman Empire. They charged toll money, and so they became wealthy. In fact, with the small boats, they even sometimes lifted them up onto the road and rolled the whole boat down it, and then dumped it back in the sea at the other end. Eventually, somebody managed to build a canal there as well. 200 years before Paul, Corinth had been destroyed by the Romans. 100 years later, Julius Caesar rebuilt it and then settled lots of old soldiers there. So this city of Corinth was not only in a good position to become wealthy, it was very Roman, very loyal and very shaped by Roman ways and by the Latin language and other things. And yet, it was in Greece. So Corinth was a city of a cosmopolitan nature. It was Greek, but it was also Roman. It was the capital of Achaia, of the southern Greek province, and it loved Greek ways, and it was proud of its Greek past, but it was very Roman too. We've dug up lots of Latin influence there. Had a big population. Its success made it more important than Athens. Athens is the one we think of as the famous Greek city. At this point, Paul's point in history, Corinth was way more important. Athens was a backwater by comparison. Corinth had come up as the city of the time. How did you see its power? You saw its power in its business. It was very successful in terms of business. You saw it in its culture. You saw it in its tourism. It had a rival, or an alternative, I don't know if it was a rival, an alternative to the Olympic Games. Do you know which was the name of the games that took place at Corinth every 2 years? Could be based on the word that Brian keeps saying for us. They were the Isthmian Games. I find that easier to say for some reason. It's the isthmus I can't do. Second only to the Olympics. So, Paul was there a year and a half. It's entirely possible Paul was there during the Games. And if he wasn't there actually during the Games, he'd have seen all the build-up when people were selling all the junk you always get when people have great sports events and stuff like that. But this cosmopolitan city of Corinth, what did it really value? What defined the city? I'm sure money had its effect. It was a wealthy city. It would do, wouldn't it? People would have gone there to find the streets of gold or whatever. Its success, no doubt, was a matter of pride. The comfort it could bring, the pleasures, were all important. But Corinth had more than that. It had something which, to us, actually would be unusual because it's not our way of looking at things. See, Corinth was a society built also on status. What mattered in Corinth, or one of the big things that mattered in Corinth, was where you stood in comparison with other people. Where you fitted into the social tree. And what was it that put you at the higher levels on the tree? The key factor was education. Now, there's a problem with that. The moment I say the word education, we think modern education, and you start thinking maths GCSE or physics A-level or a degree in something, and you've got a picture of sort of modern education. It's not that. We're not thinking in those terms. What they wanted was this. The people, the educated people in Corinth who were regarded and celebrated as higher up the tree, were the people who had learned to speak. Speaking well in public, being able to conduct yourself well with your words, having the ability to produce rhetoric, that was what got you high status. To be celebrated in Corinth, you had to be a well-trained speaker. Then you were one of the elite. Now, we find that hard to grasp, because that's not the UK. I mean, yeah, who cares about trained orators in our day? At best, maybe in courtrooms, we still admire people who can make great speeches. We don't expect our politicians to make great speeches, and we're quite surprised when any of them do. We certainly don't expect anyone else to make a great speech. When was the last time you attended a public lecture? Other than a church service, let's say, if you want to call preaching a lecture. But in Corinth, they did. The people who could speak well were the people you celebrated. Yeah, you think of the comparison. Who are our celebrities? There'll be entertainers, people who make us laugh or people who move us to tears with their acting or whatever it is. There'll be the rich, the people we admire for having made something of themselves. There'll be the sports people who have achieved some success in a contest somewhere. There'll be the people famous for being famous because they're on reality TV and they've got an Instagram account with 5 billion pictures of them in it. And all the pictures are of them, which is slightly freaky, isn't it, when you think about it? But there we go. Apparently not as freaky. People want to do that. They're the celebrities. And what attracts others to them is their looks, or their money, or the stories of their lives. You know, so any footballer, by the time he's got to the grand age of 20, must have written his autobiography, because we're all fascinated by the first 20 years. Their opinions, tweeted out in 140 characters, their fame. They're our celebrities. But we don't expect them to make great speeches. They'll go on chat shows, they'll sit down with Graham Norton, and they'll chat, and we'll all smile at their funny little tales. But we don't expect them to be orators, trained speakers who have spent 25 years learning how to proclaim well. But in Corinth, that's what you look for in your celebrities, your elite, the people who are at the top of the tree. They have been educated from childhood to speak well in public. Now, speaking well is fine. It's a good thing to do, I should think. I'd like to be able to do it. But when it becomes a source of status and pride, as it had in Corinth, when it puts you on top of others and over others, then it becomes sinful. And it had in Corinth, and so the Lord had to challenge it. Now that is what shaped Paul's mission. We're reading about Paul's mission there, and we might read some of it and think, this is a bit weird. Why did he do this? Why did he do that? And the answer is, because the Lord was challenging Corinth at her heart, what she was. Let's see a little of that in the verses, and then also see a little of it from some of the things Paul wrote later. Verse 1. Paul arrived from Athens. He left Athens and went to Corinth. Now in Athens, if you remember from 2 weeks ago, Paul did public speaking. He did it in the marketplace, debating with the philosophers. He then went to the fantastic court, the Areopagus, and there he gave this great speech where he quoted Greek poets. Paul did public speaking in Athens, in the market and the court. He did it with style. It had little impact, but he did it with style. But verse 2, he doesn't repeat it in Corinth. You might have expected him to, mightn't you? You might have thought, well, he's just done Athens. It's like the great tour now. If you've done Athens, you do Corinth. If you've been out in the public places of Athens, you're going to be out in the public places of Corinth. But he doesn't. He doesn't carry on the same policy. Instead, he simply settles into the Jewish community. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. He meets a couple, Aquila and Priscilla. We'll hear a little bit more about them later, not in this sermon, but later in the story of Acts. They've been expelled from the city of Rome at the heart of the empire by Claudius. Claudius is the current emperor, which allows us to a certain extent to date the timing of when Paul's in Corinth. There's also some other information that helps us to date when Paul was here. And Paul meets them, and he gets along well with them. They're tent makers, and he settles into the Jewish community with them. Why is Paul a tent maker? Because, you know, isn't he a sort of rabbi student and stuff? Because as a Jewish student, Paul would have learned a practical trade. It would have been part of his learning to have a practical skill. So presumably, tent making was his, unless he's learned it since. And he settles into being a tent maker along with Priscilla and Aquila. So Paul is hardly moving amongst the elite. Back in Athens, he was in the Areopagus. Here, he's in the Jewish community, who are already, to a certain extent, a little bit removed. And he's doing manual work. Well, who does manual work? This is working class. He's not exactly moving amongst the rich and famous. And then he gives his energy to the Jews. Every Sabbath, he reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Synagogue is the Jewish place of worship. Now, there are Greeks present in the synagogue. Some Greek folk who have appreciated the Jewish way of understanding God have started to come along. So Paul does get to talk with them too. But that's his focus. His focus is to be amongst the Jews, with the Jews. He goes to the Jewish place of worship every Sabbath, and that's where he reasons. Verse 5, Silas and Timothy turn up. You remember these were his friends. They were on the team when he was up in the north, up in Macedonia. He left them to go to Athens. They've now come across and joined him in Corinth. When they arrive, this frees up Paul to do extra work. I assume that's because they've now got a source of income. They've got some sort of manual work they could do. Paul can, as it were, give himself more devotedly to his preaching. So what does he do? He devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. The Jewish work grows, and that's where his focus is still. Now, eventually, it turns sour. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest. Antagonism grows. The Jewish community is starting to get irritated by this guy who is hanging around with them, going on and on about this guy, Jesus, who is the Christ, and they're not accepting it. Some are believing, but others are getting irritated now with him. And as a result, the antagonism grows to the point where Paul shakes out his clothes in protest and says to them, "Your blood be on your own heads." In other words, he does a very visible symbol as well as speaks words that says, "I won't come here anymore. You are cutting yourselves off from God. I have warned you, you're doing that. If you will not listen, I can't do any more for you. Your blood is on your own heads now. And I have no more duty before God to speak to you. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." So Paul has started with the Jews. Now, he always starts with the Jews. He believes that they are the ancient people of God, and they are the first people he ought to tell about Jesus. But they pushed him away, so what does he do next? He's going to go to the Gentiles. But where does he go? Does it say, and then Paul strode out into the marketplace or into the forum and started preaching? And then Paul went up on the hill and found any Greek he could and assailed him with the truth of Jesus? No, he goes next door. He's still in the Jewish area. He goes next door to the house of a Gentile God-fearer called Titius Justus, a worshipper of God. You'd think simply for the sake of calming down the trouble you wouldn't go next door, wouldn't you? But apparently not. He moves next door. And the synagogue ruler, Crispus, joins him and his entire household, who believes in the Lord. And many Corinthians who heard him believed and were baptized. Have you seen Paul's evangelism strategy so far? And does it make any sense to you? He has worked through a place of Jewish worship to reach a very cosmopolitan city. Is that a good idea? And when they close down that option to him, where does he go? Next door to the place of Jewish worship and starts up there instead. Have you seen his strategy? Why is he doing it? Why is he not out debating in public? He did it in Athens. He spoke at the Areopagus. He quoted the poets of Greece. Why is he not doing that in Corinth? He's bright enough, isn't he? He is. He's incredibly bright. But he's chosen to adopt a different policy. So, I've given you an introduction to the city. And we've walked through the verses to try and capture for you something of what's going on. Now, let's ponder what is actually going on. What is Paul up to? If we only had Acts 18, I guess all we could do at the best is guess. We could throw out all kinds of possibilities, couldn't we? I could say something like, "Well, you know, everyone, I think he was very upset by his time in Athens. And probably when he got to Corinth, he wasn't quite sure how to handle it all. And so he just put himself somewhere safe. He knew Jewish people. He got on with Jewish people. He went to where it was safe." I could say something like that, and it would sort of sound sensible. The only problem is Luke doesn't tell us that. So it would just be a speculation. Now, I speculate about all kinds of things, and you've heard me do it, but I don't know it would be very helpful if I did that at this moment. However, we've got some help from Paul on this. Paul actually explains to us what he was up to, and that's in a later letter that he wrote. So let me read to you now from what he wrote. This is in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 to 5. Now, I've got it on a piece of paper that I'm going to read from, but if you wanted to find it, to look it up yourself, it's on page 1145. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 to 5. Now, you listen to how Paul explains himself. When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom, as I proclaim to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you, except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness and fear and with much trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on man's wisdom, but on God's power. Now, we find that a little bit difficult to listen to because he's using phrases that would make a lot of sense to Greek people in Corinth and less sense to English people listening to it in English. But the gist is this. Paul said, when I came to your city, I would not play its game. Your city rates, celebrates the people who have the powerful words and who deliver them in powerful ways and who have been trained to be the great public speakers. And I didn't play the game. I wouldn't be your celebrity preacher. Your city loved those who were eloquent, who had been trained to speak well through years of practice since they were 2 years old. I didn't do that. Your city liked people who spoke with such a fascinating way about elements of life and philosophical understanding of it. Well, I turned up and I preached about Jesus and his death on a cross. Jesus, a completely unimportant Palestinian bloke that nobody had heard of. His death on a cross. Jesus, the Palestinian bloke who died as a slave criminal in a most obnoxious way that polite Romans don't talk about. In other words, I didn't play the game. I could have gone up into the city. I could have found a big lecture hall. I could have given fascinating insights into understanding the gods through a Jewish perspective. I didn't. I talked about a dead slave criminal. And people thought I was weird because I wouldn't play the game. I kept on about Jesus' death on a cross, which gave Jesus no status points whatsoever in Corinthian society. A grotesque, vile criminal. Now, understandably, says, as Paul says, he found that quite nerve-wracking. Who wouldn't? Given that Corinth loved her celebrity speakers, who wants to appear like a clown? Because that's what he came across as. So he says, well, when I spoke, I mean, it didn't go well for me. He said, my voice trembled. My general demeanour really didn't impress people. Elsewhere in another letter, he'll write about how unimpressive he was physically when he was with people. He wasn't rated wise by the people who knew who the significant movers and shakers were. He wasn't rated as in the ranks of the top speakers when the top 10 came out each week. That didn't really happen, I just made that up. Well, it might have happened, but I don't know. In other words, put it very simply, Paul's evangelistic technique in Corinth was not suited to the culture. It was not in touch with people. It didn't pander to what they already loved, and it came across as irrelevant. And yet, verse 8 in Acts 18 says this, many of the Corinthians who heard him believed and were baptized. How on earth did that happen? Paul did it all wrong. What did he say in 1 Corinthians 2? My message and preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power. He depended on the Spirit to convert people, and the Spirit did. God saved people. Paul came across as an idiot in his speaking, and God saved people through it. Listen to him writing slightly earlier in that letter, which we read earlier. This is 1 Corinthians 1. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs, and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, stumbling block to the Jews, foolishness to Gentiles, but to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Corinth was proud of her speakers. They speak so well. The Lord, through Paul, the failed speaker, didn't pander to it. Can I just say, and pause at this moment and say, I find that tremendously reassuring. Maybe nobody else does, but I do. Yet some of us in this room, including me, worry about our words. And we worry about our words for all kinds of reasons. Some of us worry because we look stupid in our words. Our words just aren't that clever and we come across as stupid. Some of us are worried about our words because we think we won't know answers when we're talking to people. And they might throw something at us and we don't know what to say. And, oh, how am I going to answer that? I'll have no answer. Some of us worry about our words because we get very, very anxious about harsh responses. We're okay if people are talking nicely to us, but the moment it gets a bit edgy, we get edgy, we get all sweaty, we get worried, we're not sure what to say. Some of us worry about our words because we think we're just going to run out of words. You know, some people have the gift of the gab and they go on and on. You put them in a room, you sit down and you can switch off for half an hour because they'll just talk. But some of us can't do that. You sit down in a room and unless somebody else is talking, we sit there. And it gets quite uncomfortable after a while, doesn't it? Because you don't know what to say and it's really difficult. Some of us worry about our words because when we speak, we get clumsy. We start sort of putting words backwards or we start stuttering a bit or whatever it might be and we feel we're tripping over ourselves and we just meant to say that but we said this. And then we started a sentence but we realised we hadn't said what would explain the sentence we were saying. So the other person's looking at us thinking, I don't know what you're going on about. And on top of that, some of us have personalities which simply find it hard to speak sometimes. If we meet strangers, we don't know what to say. We can't overcome the shyness, which feels like an actual physical barrier in front of us. And initiating conversations is a nightmare. How are you supposed to start a conversation with somebody? Maybe all of us, or at least some of us in this room, worry about our words in all kinds of contexts. And then, as Christians, we think, well, clearly I'm failing the Lord then. Because the Lord expects me to speak, because the gospel depends upon me speaking. So I'm failing the Lord because my words are failing. No, you're not. No, you're not. The Lord does not depend on your speaking ability. He really doesn't. When the Lord changes a heart, changes a person, he does it by his Spirit. Not because you were brilliant in giving an answer when they threw something at you. Not because you managed to initiate a conversation in the most remarkable way ever by twisting something onto spiritual topics. He saves people by his Spirit. And we don't need to beat ourselves up feeling I failed the Lord because my words are so appallingly bad. Paul, on purpose in Corinth, looked like an idiot. But the Lord saved people through the message of Jesus and the cross. You have a simple duty as a Christian, to live as a Christian. You have a simple duty as a Christian to honour the Lord as best you can in the circumstances you're put into. Do not panic about your words. Do not beat yourself up about, oh, I failed again, I didn't overcome this trait of my personality, this weakness in my words, I didn't become as eloquent as so-and-so, because when you put him into a situation, he just talks about Jesus. You put me into the situation, I don't get past asking for two sugars in my coffee. It's not down to your words. You aim just to honour the Lord with what you've been given the best way you can. Leave it to him to save people. It's not the eloquence. So I find all of this quite reassuring personally. Paul went then countercultural in Corinth, as the gospel must. He wouldn't pander to what mattered to them. Now, one last thing I want to do in wrapping up Acts 18 for this morning, because I think there's probably one more thing I need to say, and I think we ought to go there. Some preachers, modern preachers now, some preachers get very confused about Corinth, I think. Because they look at Paul and they think Paul actually did the very opposite of everything I've just said. They actually think Paul played to the local culture. Anybody want to suggest why they might think he did that? A passage from his letter that he later wrote, which makes people think Paul did the opposite of what I've just said. Anybody want to suggest the passage? Ah, I think Ferris is pointing us to 1 Corinthians 9, where Paul writes this. Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak, to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. Did Paul just say the opposite of what he'd said in chapter 2? Isn't that saying that Paul had a policy of becoming just like the locals and making himself fully relevant? I'll tell you what, just to give you an example, here is a modern preacher talking about this passage. This was a few years ago now, so it's slightly dated, as in it's 12 years ago, it's slightly dated, but you'll get the gist. This is a modern preacher. If he was alive today, Paul would say to the indie rockers, I did indie rock. To the hip hoppers, I did hip hop. To the tech guys, I had a blog. To the families, I talked about marriage and kids and parenting. For the business guys, I should point that way, shouldn't I, to the city. For the business guys, I did financial seminars and connected it back to God. For the environmental rights activists, I told them who the creator was, since they enjoy his work so much. In these verses, Paul is saying, I tried to figure out how to articulate Jesus in as many ways as I possibly could, to as many people as I possibly can, to win as many people as possible. Sounds good. Except we've already read chapter 2. And in chapter 2, Paul said he didn't pander to people. He didn't say to the indie rockers, I do indie rock. And he didn't say to the hip hoppers, I do hip hop. He didn't pander to the culture. So what on earth is he going on about? His words were countercultural. So what is 1 Corinthians 9 about? I don't think it's that difficult. 1 Corinthians 9 is about personal lifestyle. Paul isn't, in 1 Corinthians 9, describing his evangelistic technique. When I came to Corinth, I went on chat shows, because Corinth loves chat shows. He's not talking about his evangelistic technique. He means this. He would not let his personal preferences ever stop him speaking to anyone. his own lifestyle would not be a hindrance to him mixing with people of different lifestyles. That's what he means. It's not the technique he adopts, but it's his willingness to mix with anyone. When he says to the Jews, "I became a Jew," he means this. I went to Jewish houses, and when I got there, they said to me, "Now you'll wash your hands, won't you? Because we all wash our hands ceremonially before the meal." Now Paul could have said, "No, I gave all that up." But he didn't. He just quietly washed his hands and went through to the meal. And then he went to a Gentile house and he walked in through the door and they said, "Surprise, prawn salad." And Paul hadn't eaten prawns through his life because they're unclean. He didn't go, "I'll just get a takeout and I'll be back." He sat down and he ate prawns. He didn't let his personal preferences, his lifestyle, hinder his mixing with other people, because he wanted to tell them the gospel. And that's what he means. You can put it this way. In Corinth, Paul was not culturally relevant, but he was friendly. He mixed with all for the Lord, even when it made him uncomfortable. And maybe that's the last thing to leave ourselves with, because we should try and do the same, shouldn't we? There are people in this life who we like to mix with, because we're really comfortable around them. And there are people in this life we'd rather not mix with. Because they make us uncomfortable. And Paul would say, just don't stand off. Yeah, sometimes you're going to have to suppress your own personal choices to mix with that woman, that bloke. But suppress your own choice. Go and talk to them. Go and mix with them. So long as it doesn't lead you into sin, go and mix with them. Suppress your own personal preference in favour of showing love and honouring the Lord. But as you do so, he might add, don't panic about your words, because the Spirit will deal with that.